Yes, as promised, people, this is part two of this week's Echo Chamber. And we check out a new documentary and then speak to the man behind it. It's a fun episode, people, so let's get it popping. Okay, so we're starting off with this new documentary, Wild Water. Okay, people, so thanks to Robin Dean over at Marguerite, I was able to check out Wild Waters. Right, this is the new documentary from Ben Davis. It's produced by Pete Jenkinson. Ben also co-produces. Right, we've got cinematography from Jeff Brockhate. It's edited by Joe Dale. There's not a whole lot of, it's not listed on IMDb. There's not, like, we don't get the cast list or anything, which is, you know, always a bit of a pain. It's essentially about Gadding Dan, which is a reservoir hidden in the West Yorkshire Moors, 780 feet above sea level. The bleak but romantic landscape, steeped in the poetry and prose of Ted Hughes and the Brontes. It's the home to the UK's highest beach. The small strip of sand acts as a magnet to a community of swimmers, day trippers, walkers, bikers, and runners. There's a rhythm as people come and go, having made the 20-minute trek up a broken footpath, each drawn to the beauty as it changes with the seasons. Always the same, always different. Some hardened locals brave the wind, rain, and snow to wild swim. All seasons for escape, camaraderie to keep the black dog at bay, or just for sheer thrill. As they hit the water, all experience the same visual hit, taking away everything except the moment. Time stops and peace arrives. But there is more to this place than just swimming. A whole ecosystem of activity circulates around the reservoir. There are the volunteers who maintain the footpath in all weathers, the pub landlord fighting to keep vehicles out of his car park, the farmer and whose cattle need rescuing, the Gadding Dan Preservation Society, and the January Daily Dippers. So yeah, that's what it is about. And we, you know, it's beautiful, right? I mean, if you've been to Yorkshire, there are some just fantastic places to walk, right? It's like, there's so many lovely places around the country, you know, like I love Windermere, you know what I mean? Going there, walking. But yeah, Yorkshire is just as nice. So there's this, this reservoir, supposedly, right, it was shown on a show called Country File, right? And it was a bit of a secret. Not many people knew about it until Country File kind of like let the cat out the bag. So people go there, right? People go there to wild swim and hang out and, you know, enjoy the countryside. But yeah, we're kind of following in this group of people who, like, it started with this January dip, a few people posting it online, which then got more people to come and join them. And now there's this group, this community, this family, right? So we're looking at these people, But on top of that, right, you just think, okay, so it's, you know, them doing this whole swim in the cold, right? These crazy people swimming outside. But, you know, they talk about their lives and how, you know, it's impacted them, right? You've got a lady that was just going through this whole situation in her life. She left her family, you know, and really found comfort in the swimming, right? Another lady, you know, she was teased at work, right? Someone's like, oh, you should do a triathlon. And she was just like, oh, fuck it, I'm going to go do this. And so she started out slowly, done a few, you know, coming last, but, you know, slowly improving, right? So all of these different people and just the way they navigate this. So you get that interesting look, right? We find out that the local community, the local town, bought the reservoir, you know? They didn't really say if it was going to be closed or what the situation actually was, but they bought the reservoir and now they, you know, maintain it themselves, right? So it really is this local fixture. And everyone just talks about, you know, the experience, right? Because it's definitely an experience like hitting cold water, right? Hitting cold water is a thing. So I used to go surfing in hail. And yo, when you first get in that motherfucking water, yo, woo, it just, boy, it hits you. But here's the thing, you start moving and it goes, right? You don't really notice the cold at all, you know? So yeah, like surfing at least twice a day, right? Getting in that cold water, I get it. I get that buzz, that feel. But yeah, it's just these people just talking about what it does to them. Like that spirituality, you know, that feeling of focus. Because I mean, you definitely feel focused. Like suddenly everything else is gone, right? You're just dealing this cold, this shock through your system. And it's just like, yo, okay, gotta move, right? I'm moving. Okay, that's what I'm moving. What am I doing? I'm going to hit that wave. That's what I'm doing. So you just drilled in. And that's definitely a thing. So, yeah, we just have all of these people talking about, like, the experience and all of this. Some of the people seem to be like they want to swim naked, which they didn't really explain why, right? Didn't really explain why you want to swim naked, right? Like, yeah, they didn't really have explain that aspect of it. It's a guy with a ukulele. I would drown him if I was there. I'd have to drown him. Yeah, ukuleles annoy me so much. They fucking annoy me, man. Yo, you know what I mean? Like, I'm cool with the cold water. It's just this motherfucking ukulele, yo. But no, they all see, you know, he seemed fine. There's this walk. This woman called it her, the hell hill. I mean, not very original, but you know what I mean? But she's like, it's this steep hill that you climb to get to the reservoir. And, you know, like, I'm just like, yo, if you're doing this every day, it's not going to be that tough, right? Because you get used to it, right? It's fit. I just remember the beach going surfing on in Hale. There is, like, it's a steep walk down to it, But it's just like, yo, you're doing that multiple times a day, right? It's just like, yo, it's nothing. It's a little bit, you know, it's a buzz. It's a buzz before you get into that water. But yeah, some people saying, you know, it's done wonders for certain health conditions. You know, a guy with ADHD says it has helped him focus. Women in the menopause say, you know, it helped with all those hot flushes and other things such as that. So there's just all of these benefits health-wise. But then, like, as a community, you can see that it is, I think, bringing these people together, but kind of just doing wonders for the well-being, right? So we see all of that, which is great. Now, you know, it's on top of this hill. It's in the, you know, the hills of Yorkshire. So the cinematography is lovely, right? We get these great views and everything. And also, like, we get these shots, some underwater, some following people as they're swimming, which does help kind of bring you into it all, right? Bring you close into the action. So you kind of get that feel for things. So it's really, it is really interesting, right? It touches on other things, like, you know, this pub, there's a pub close by. And I think a lot of people, because of this show Country File, park in his car park and outside and causing a bit of an issue. Doesn't, like, it mentions it, but it doesn't really talk about, right, how he's combating it or solutions, right? So there are a few things that get touched on that don't really go anywhere, but I think the main thing of this is just showing what this does, right? What it brings to people. And I think we definitely get that, right? We definitely get how just this act, this, you know, daily act for some has transformed their lives, which is fantastic, you know. And I think if you don't want a wild swim, right, there's probably something that could do the same for you, right? Like, for me, like, surfing was that, you know, for a thing for a bit, jiu-jitsu, you know what I mean? Pilates, there's a load of things that are real interesting I can really just, you know, use to help that mental health, you know what I mean? Just to invigorate you. Right. And there's always something like that. So I think, well, this shows you there are these things that can do that, can help you, you know, refocus your life. So, you know, it's very interesting in that regard. And yeah, I think these people in January, a big part of it is they raise money for charity, and crisis being one of them. Right. So this is being distributed along with crisis. So, yeah, you know, it's a homeless charity. So I think, you know, hey, you know, that's a good cause. So, you know, I think supporting the film helps that. So, you know, there is that as well, people. But all the release information will be on the website and their website. So all the links will be there so you can follow through. You know what I mean? Check if it's screening anywhere near you, how you can maybe donate to Crisis, how you might be able to go to Gadding Dan and try a little dip as well. You know? The one thing that was a bit like, is because they pee in the reservoir. Yeah. Yeah, that's the, but it's like in a swimming pool, it's nasty, but there's chlorine, right? But in a reservoir, there's no chlorine. There's no chlorine. So you have people peeing and whatever in there. Yeah, that's not great. That's not appealing. You know what I mean? But yeah, wild swimming. I know my friend Alex is probably, you know what I mean, all over this, right? So, yeah, how you feel? You want to go wild swimming, people? Maybe just watch Wild Water instead. And now, people, it is time for a very engrossing conversation with the man, Ben Davis. Okay, people, so today I am joined by Ben Davis, the writer, the director, producer of Wild Water. Ben, thank you very much for your time, man. Really appreciate
it. Well, thank you for having me. I fully appreciate it.
No problem at all. So, you know, wild swimming, right? That's it's not for the faint-hearted.
Have you tried it?
I used to go surfing a lot in Hale. So, right. The water was not hot.
It's a thing. I mean, I've been doing it. How long have I been doing it? Maybe 3 years now. And I kind of, when did I start? I think it's maybe even at the start of lockdown, we were all kind of, everyone was looking for these little micro adventures. And there's a dam. And yeah, it's like where I live is very, very rural, and we're in a place called the Calder Valley, which is in West Yorkshire, kind of equidistant between Manchester and Leeds. Beautiful part, used to be quite industrial, but it's still very rural. And there's a amazing dam up near, it's about 20 minutes from where I live, and it's peculiar. It's like you've got these moors, and then you walk up this hill and you look down, there's this massive old mill pond kind of surrounded by rocks going all around it. I mean, it's pretty big, not a huge reservoir, but it's, you know, big enough.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people go up there swimming Saturday mornings all the year round. And then, yeah, I can't quite remember the first time I did it now. It was probably when we were making this film, actually, because the reason the film came around was because I was went up there for a picnic with my wife and son. And this was a few years ago, and he was about 3 or 4, and it was beautiful. It was, the sun was setting, midsummer, and it was like being in Italy. You're kind of, yeah, it was just like, it didn't feel like you're on top of a moor in West Yorkshire. And there were a couple of old boys there who were training for a triathlon, and chatting with them. And then there was an old couple, and they were like, "Oh, well, we come up here and walk our dogs every day." And if lots of cyclists going past, and everyone's kind of having a chat and be able to spend the time of day. And then I kind of thought, there's quite a nice little community going on here. And that kind of planted the seed for a film idea, because there's always a load of stories kind of bubbling away. And then lockdown hit, we had another film project going. That, which I may talk about later, that kind of, because of the nature of it, that was a lot of live music, so we couldn't do that. So I kind of thought, well, we've got a film idea here that is local. We can do it reasonably cheap. It means I don't have to go anywhere. It's what, we can film it all outdoors, all that kind of stuff. So it just felt like a really nice little project. And it was started off as a kind of a 10-minute film idea, and it's 52 minutes now, as these things tend to escalate. And by the time we started filming, lockdown was pretty much over as well. So I've got the timing wrong. But it proved a real. So that wild swimming, I think when we first were talking about it and we went in, me and the producer Pete went in for a swim, and yeah, you kind of get the bug. First time went in, it was like 30 seconds a minute screaming and effing and jeffing, and then you get out and you go, oh, maybe I could have stayed in longer, and it gives you quite a buzz. And then because I was filming, people are getting in touch with people to go swimming or to have a chat, and they're like, well, if you're coming up, you might as well have a swim. It's like, oh, okay, well. And then before you know it, you're doing it regularly, and you can see why other people are doing it.
Yeah, I kind of find as soon as you start moving, you kind of start to forget about the cold.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's an initial kind of, I mean, I use these, not everyone, but most people use these kind of gloves and socks. And they're like, you know, neoprene kind of wetsuit. And they really take the sting of it. I it takes me longer to get in the summer when I haven't got them on, because you get the water up to your midriff and you're like, and then with the gloves and socks, I don't know, you just pile straight in, you know, and no matter how cold it is. And I went in this week and it was like 8 degrees. And I'd kind of, you know, you've always got a frisson of excitement before you go in. And then as it went in, it was like, oh, actually, it's quite warm. It's not too bad. I mean, don't get me wrong, 5 minutes later, you're like, yeah, I need to get out. It's pretty nice. So I think a lot of it is in the head. I guess that was my point. And the first time, your expectations are kind of, I'm not going to be able to stay in long here. This is going to be a nightmare. And then you go, oh, actually, it's fine. And once you're going to get over that, and it does a few swims, you know, 4 or 5 swims in, and you're kind of pretty well hardened to it, really.
Mm. Yes. Yeah, that was a thing. Like the first time going surfing, it was just like, there's the buzz of going surfing, but it's just like, yo, what's the water gonna be like? You know, and it's just like, oh. But then you get in and you start moving, you're like, all right, this is all right, I can do this. And then you're just looking forward to the next time, and you know it's cold the next time, but you're kind of prepared, so it's it's not as fear-inducing, you know what I mean? So you just become used to it, and it's just that, you know, okay, there's gonna be a few seconds of and then everything's gonna be fine.
And did you go, have you been in winter, or was it purely kind of summer?
Yeah, no, so we were going in October.
Oh wow, okay, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that can get pretty nippy. I mean, we've got, in fact, in our last film, there's footage of a chap surfing in northern Norway, and you know they're in full kind of, I mean, it's a beautiful drone shot, and you've got the snow and ice and everywhere, and he's like, you know, kind of swimming along in a full dry suit, I presume, but still, that's I look at that and I think, yeah, that's pretty hardcore. Getting your face wet in like 1 degree, 2 degree water is, yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure I could do that. Well, I guess I said that about swimming once. So maybe it's just learn my own lessons. It's all about expectation.
Oh, dear. What was it like? Because I think the big thing with this is it's not just about these wild swimmers, right? We get that look at these people's lives and how, like, this community and how this, you know, morning swim has impacted them and helped, you know, redefine who they are. So what was it like building those connections?
Oh, it's brilliant. I mean, it's the thing I most like about filmmaking is getting to know people and getting to hear their stories. It always feels like a real privilege when people want to share stuff that they've been through, and you know, you approach a lot of people and then you find that the people who say yes, you get, once you get the mic on and once you get the camera on, they're kind of, you know, it almost all comes out, and they're just up for telling you everything. And it's a real privilege to hear that, and it's just nice meeting lots of different people and kind of it's almost, you have license to pry. You know, I guess if you're in a, like for instance, one of the characters, Emma, who's turned into a friend, and she hasn't been able to have children for various different reasons. Her stepdaughter actually got pregnant, and she found that relationship very difficult, because, you know, there's a certain amount of envy, things that were quite a thing to share. But, you know, I could have met her, been friends with her for years. Now, you would never dream of saying, so why haven't you got kids? Or you have this license to actually kind of explore people's lives, and they're inviting you in. So I find that fascinating and really interesting. And I love people. I like to find out about people and hearing their stories. And everyone's got a story to tell. You ask anyone and no one's going to go, nothing's happened to me. Everyone, you know, if you kind of dig under the bonnet, everyone's got something. You'd be like, oh my God, that's like unbelievable to them or to their family or something. So yeah, that is brilliant. And the good thing about swimming thing is you have this another activity. There's something to do because we've done. It's quite intense when you're sat. Well, you can sit with people, but if you're swimming, there's this act. It's built around an activity. Mm. And my idea with the film was to have the dam, Gaddings Dam, would be the central character, and it would be the central character off which we would tell people's stories, or everyone's kind of peripheral to the dam. It was like a what's the word? Oh, can't think of the word. A way of being able to tie everyone's stories together, really. And it gave you a certain amount of parameters. When quite a bit of filming we did in people's houses and we did in other places, and it never quite worked. You always felt like you wanted to come back to the dam. And I think a lot of artistic and creative things, it's easier to work within a set of boundaries. It's like going to the studio making music. You can have a million plugins, a million different instruments, but actually you go, just give me two instruments and tell me I can work on that, and you'll make something far more interesting if you're working within certain parameters. I think I've gone totally off. I don't know what the question was.
No. I mean, you answered it, right? Yeah.
In what was really interesting in going to picking up on the point of someone being ready to share stuff is that on our last film, Northern Disco Lights, which is about Norwegian dance music, and within that, there's one of the main story arcs is there's a young lad called Torre. His recorded name is Erot, and he was this kind of musical genius, and everyone spoke very highly of him. And he had a kind of a heart defect, and he'd been very poorly as a child, and he'd kind of had some quite near-death experiences. And he was kind of very successful, and then he died when he was very young, like 22, 23, I think. And we got in touch with his, I mean, this was when we were filming, it was probably 20 years ago, 20 years before. Yeah, 15, 20 years. And then we managed to hook up with his sisters and we interviewed them, and they were like, well, would your parents be up for being filmed? And they were like, oh, well, we'll ask. And they really talked about it. And we spoke to some of Torre's friends, and they were, his parents, we're very close, but they took a real step back because I think they just found the whole thing too traumatic. Mm. And then, we met them, and it was this slowly, slowly. And by the time we sat down to interview them, it was this very, very special interview. And then it was very emotional talking about, how he died and the build up to it. And then just as we were like, okay, well, that's a wrap. And his dad went kind of, well, it's just something I want to say. And he was this kind of quite reserved Norwegian middle-aged chap. And he just said, at the funeral, Torre's funeral, and all his friends came, and, we just found it so overwhelming. It was so amazing, and it meant so much to us that the church was so full. And you listen to it, you're thinking, he's never said that to anyone. And he started crying, and it's like he was just waiting, not for the opportunity, but he was just great. I think grateful to be able to express his gratitude, really. Mm. So there was that thing of putting a camera on and people prepare for it, and then that they want to tell their story, and sometimes often happy with that opportunity. I think.
Yeah, I also feel it's the way you communicate with people.
Mm.
Right, because if you're just like, oh, tell me, like people can clam up a bit. But if you just broach subjects in a comfortable way, people feel relaxed and will open up more to you. Mm. You know what I mean? If they can feel comfortable with you, you can get a lot out of people. So, I think it's, it was your abilities to be able to communicate with them for them to want to open up like that.
Well, it's all about empathy and trust, basically. Mm. And I think it's important that I like everyone that I've interviewed. And I'm very, empathetic, it is. Because when people tell you the things that are going on in their lives, it is genuinely kind of, not everywhere, it's genuinely emotional. And I really kind of get that. And I think, hopefully, that's what I bring as a filmmaker, is my empathy. I think it's probably my best the thing I'm best at, hopefully, you know, technical stuff, because I'm very late to it. So technical stuff, I'm not great. I don't really know what I'm doing, but hopefully I've got the empathy bit right.
I mean, technically, you say technically you don't know what you do. There were some lovely shots in Wild
Kevin,
Wonder.
I'll let you into a secret. I didn't do them.
You could have just been like, oh yeah, well, you know, it's just tried. I won it. I got that.
No, but we had a brilliant DOP cameraman. I mean, I'm music. That's what I've done, DJ, and made music for 20, 25 years. And so I don't actually, it's like I haven't been through film school. You know, if someone goes, you know, what camera did you use? I'm like, yeah, good one. Which is something I need to get better at. But our first film, you know, the DOP, I know what I want, and I know I know what I want to see, and I know what I want to communicate, and I know what story I want to tell. But from a technical point of view, you know, it's that thing. It's like with a DJ, you could give two DJs the same set of records, and one could smash it, and the other guy would be like, yeah, it was all right. And I think it's the same with taking photos or filming. You know, you could give me a camera. I could take a picture of the same thing, and the cameraman will take a picture. I'll be like, oh, God, your picture's great. And mine's, like, very average. Mm. So when I say I didn't do it. But, I instructed him, I guess.
Mm. But I think that's an important thing, though, right? Because I feel being able to get someone to give someone the vision to translate it into what you want, there's a skill in that.
Mm.
You know, it's just like there's a load of projects I've managed over the years, and you're working with agencies and graphic designers and things like that. And it's just like, oh, this is what I have in my head, right? This is what I mean, you do little sketches sometimes, or you're just talking people through the process, but it's being able to communicate that to someone to give you that thing. Because otherwise, you know, DOP is just, you know, they're doing their thing, right? But you have to give them the guidance to
let
you know where to go with it all, you know? So there's there's definitely a skill in that. And I don't think you need to know everything, right? It's just like, you know, it takes years to build up certain skills and all of that kind of thing. But, you know, if you have the right people around you, you can do wonders, man. You know what I mean? And that's what you did right here.
Well, that's kind of what I'm thinking. What I thought last time was after we finished the last film, and I thought, should I go and try and learn this stuff? And I thought, actually, no, I can't face it. It feels like I'm happy to focus on the story. It's like anything. It's like if you got the story right, everything else falls into, you know, you could have, it's like music. You can have if you've got an amazing song, you could record it in a really shit way, it would still be a great song. Whereas you could have a shit song and you could throw the best studio, best producer, and it's still going to be a shit song that will sound good. And it's like this. And I thought, well, actually, what I want to do is concentrate on the story and concentrate on the people. I don't want to have a camera worrying about exposure, you know, that the whole thing.
Yeah.
Actually, I want to be totally engaged with who I'm talking to. And it feels like that is definitely the most important thing to do. And I kind of, and learning at this at quite a late stage as well, it feel like I still would not be as good as someone who's been doing it for 30 years, you know, whatever I do.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think there's getting the understanding of the basics so you can communicate with people about, you know, what you're wanting and all of that kind of thing. But yeah, you know, I think it's just, you know, building those relationships, having the right people around you to help you do something, because, you know, there's these things that you just literally can't do on your own. So you need people there. So utilize them, utilize other people's skills, and then just, you know what I mean? Just focus on what you do well. Right. And you know what you do well. Right.
Yeah. And that, I mean, the good thing about what we do when is myself and Pete, the producer, he's become my best mate, and we've run the label together for 25 years. And it's all slightly control freakery, which I think everyone creative can be. But there's something quite nice in that it's a super small team, which you know, we had one DOP. I ended up doing the sound, which I didn't really know anything about. So the sound in the first interviews is appalling, which we managed to rescue. And then by the end, it's like I kind of knew what I was doing, and it's pretty good. but yeah, there's something in that. Just yeah, you build a really small team and you really trust them, and that seems to be a formula that has really worked. And it feels like the more people you have, the more diluted it gets. And I'm quite territorial, yeah, controlly about what I want and what I know will work as a director, I guess. So I'm always slightly paranoid. It's like you start getting more people involved, I guess. And also, money-wise, we've been very fortunate. This one we've self-financed. The last one we got some grant money in Norway. So I've actually not had to kind of adapt anything for anyone else. I've not had anyone else making demands on me. Right. It may change with the next film. But yeah, and there's something it's how we've done the record label, it's how I've done my music, and how we've ended up doing the films. And it seems to be working. So that I think that is our formula that we're keeping up with.
I mean, that's always great, right? Not having that worry, you know what I mean? And being able to do your thing, because being able to just do your thing and focus in that way, we get these stories. Because, you know, if it's down to just a major, you know, distributor, right? Are they going to want to tell a story like this? Not all the time. Or they'll tell it in a certain way, right? So I think we need, you know, it's the beauty of indie film, right? But we can get so many diverse stories and takes on things that, you know, just opens things up to so many people. Because there's a load of people that would not know of this reservoir, right? Would not know, they don't know, really know about Wild Swimming. So it's just like, you know what I mean? It's transformative a lot of the times.
Well, it's interesting that we won a best feature documentary at a Hawaii Film Festival, which is a new film festival, and which we were thrilled with. It was very unexpected. We were just kind of, you know, there's a platform and you apply to enter a film with these things. And then, and I was kind of, what's really the thing that I've liked most about it is that the stories have obviously translated. Because if you live in Hawaii and you look at this pretty brutal, austere, essentially industrial wild reservoir, you must look at it and just go, why the fuck would you swim in that? I mean, Christ, I mean, it's just... but those generic stories are still there, and I also am amazed they could understand what anyone was saying. there's some quite thick northern accents going on. You think, yeah, if you're in Hawaii, you're like, what language are they speaking?
They're just probably thinking, oh man, they don't even have to worry about sharks. That must be nice.
Yeah. They were like, what temperature is it? Well, as it comes on, we put the water temperature in it every time someone goes in. I think I prefer to go swimming in Hawaii, to be fair. Another interesting thing about Gaddis is you're allowed to swim in it, because a lot of places you're just not allowed to swim in them, because they're all private reservoirs or owned by the water board. So, and there's been a big freedom to swim. There's the Kinder Scout freedom to roam, which happened famously, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago, and that changed the law. And someone did one in a reservoir near Kinder Scout as well. So that is another reason why a lot of people go to Gaddings Dam, is because you're actually allowed to do it.
Right. Yeah. I've been to Windermere a good few times.
Yeah.
And that I love just walking around the Lake District. And I think you sometimes see people swimming in the lakes, which... I'm always just like, yo, that's something.
We're going through for the Kendall Mountain Festival next week, and there, me, the editor, and Pete, I think we're all gonna have to go for a swim while we're up there.
Oh, I mean, it'd be wrong not to, right?
Well, exactly. And I think when we promote the film, we're gonna try and hook in with some swimming groups. There's all sorts of swimming groups around the country. What we'd like to do is do something at the Hampstead Ponds and do some kind of screening somewhere. We've only just finished the film, so it's been quite. We've been stuck in post production, but it's so now it's done. We feel like we can really kind of get our teeth into it, Yeah, so it'd be nice to do it is and go around these different swimming spots and have a swim in the morning or swim in the evening or whenever, and then show a film, you know, kind of at a certain time as well.
It feels like a view.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think when we do it and show it in Hebden Bridge, which is where we're based, they've got a beautiful old picture house. So we can do a screening there, do a Q&A, do a swim in the morning with some of the characters. You know, it'll all just be this lovely little... it'll all just hook up like really nice.
Like the swim is the greet and meet, as it
were. Exactly.
So, I think there's a screen on a barge.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
I forget what it's called. It's somewhere in London, but they do screenings on a barge. And I wonder if it's in a place where you can swim as well.
Yeah, I'm not sure I want to go swimming in any canals in London, though.
It's a little judgmental, Ben. Yeah,
you know, I was down there a couple of weeks ago and I walked past and going, oh, yeah, I'm not sure if I fancy going in there. Because if you want to get into the kind of cold water swimming, any body of water you go past, you're always like eyeing it up thinking, oh, yeah, could I just slip in there? We went to Paris over the summer, and I was quite eager to swim in the Seine, and they're getting that clean for the Olympics next year, I think. And that's going to be really exciting. I think you can swim in Berlin. I mean, there's these cleaning up of the waterways kind of in major cities, which I think is really exciting. It's such a great resource, and all this, I think everyone's on the same page. I mean, especially here at the moment, you think the people having water that's so dirty you can't swim in. I mean, I just don't get it. I mean, surely everyone wants clean water. I mean, it seems madness, really. Yeah. So the thought that they're getting clean water in major cities, I think it's really exciting. I mean, the thought of the Thames, what if the Thames is clean? Oh, God, what a dream.
I mean, yeah, that would definitely be something to clean that out.
But I think it's cost billions to do the same.
I think like it's probably only being done because of the Olympics, right? That will gets generated by the tourism and you know, the sponsorships and all of that kind of thing makes it a viable thing to do. Go, man.
Well, imagine it would have a huge knock on. You kind of think that if you have that. Invest in that clean. If you have a clean river, I just can't. I have absolutely nothing to back this up with, but I imagine it would generate income.
Yeah, no, because I think you have to look at it at what. Okay, what would happen if this was clean, right? And you could then go, okay, we could have swimming clubs. We could have, you know what I mean, like yachting, like canoeing and just all of these things. So you then think of the business opportunities, right? So if you have these, then they pay, you know, a little fee to operate, boom, boom, boom. So you're getting that money. So you're getting, so it can be viable, but I don't think anyone oftentimes looks at that aspect of it. You know what I mean? Which is the crazy part, especially when you think of how many Lidos used to be all over the place. Used to be all like there was where I lived, there was you can see that there used to be a couple. They've opened the Better Group have opened one with the Greenwich Council. So I do have a big Lido near me. You know, and there's a few of those that have reopened around the country, but yeah, you know, having more spaces to swim would just be, I mean, it'd be great. And you just think about how that then, right, translates to actual swimming, you know what I mean? And people swimming and being able to compete. And then you've got like, you know, going to the Olympics and other competitions and things like that, because it starts with the grassroots. It starts with the access to being able to swim, you know? So having spaces where people can do that is only beneficial to, you know, industry and, you know, just Yeah, I mean, well-being, just, you know, as your connection with crisis, really, that's a huge big thing.
Yeah, I mean, that worked out brilliantly, because the film is bookmarked by, there's a thing called the January Daily Dip, and that is people go, well, it does what it says on the tin. People go swimming every day in January to raise money for crisis, and that we kind of follow some of the people through the film as they swim through January. So yeah, it was just the absolute perfect kind of charity partnership to have with them, and they're super keen to get involved. So yeah, that works really well, and also it's great for us to feel like we're contributing to, you know, kind of an awareness of a charity like Crisis as well.
Yeah, no, for sure, right? Some of those people were swimming naked. Like, did they explain to you why?
Mate, you wouldn't believe the amount of people that swim naked. I spoke to Vicky, who's one of the protagonists, and she was like, she's the one who says, well, like, she swims naked all the time. Mm. She worked out there were 60 people who swim up there naked.
Okay.
Not for you then, Kevin, I'm guessing.
I'm just like, I don't know about that, right? Like, I mean, it's not necessarily, I feel it would be colder, but I don't know if I want to be in water with people just swimming around no clothes on. I'm just like, you know what I mean? Just the
when they're underwater, you can't see their bits and bobs.
Yeah, but also, but my thing is, and the difficulty I have swimming outside is, like, my sight is horrendous. So when you've got the sun shining on and the reflect, I cannot see anything. So sometimes you just crash into people. And if I'm swimming and I'm crashing into someone, I don't want my hand to be like, yo, oh shit. Yo,
you know what I mean? Get like, hold of something, okay, you shouldn't be getting a hold of.
My bad.
It is. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I go naked sometimes. It depends who I'm with. And it is that thing, if someone's embarrassed, then you're embarrassed. Do you know what I mean? If no one's embarrassed, one's embarrassed. And I think it's quite a cultural thing in the UK, certainly, for we just brought up wearing clothes. Yeah, nakedness is just not part of our culture. As you go to, you go on the continent, it's, God, I mean, it's like you can't, yeah, you go any kind of gym situation or sauna situation, there's no one's got any clobber on.
Oh, yeah, Scandinavia, they all sauna naked.
Well, my wife, as I say, she lived in Amsterdam for a while. She used to go to this huge spa, and she had no one, you know, thousands of people in there, no one had any clothes. I was like, did you ever run into anyone from work? And she was like, no, and thank God for that. That was a bit of a step too far. I do think it's just cultural. Yeah, I'm trying to think. I'm going through a list of who I'd swim naked with and who I wouldn't now. But two, like Vicky and Clive, two of them, they go naked all the time, and they're just like, well, and it's almost like I would have felt a bit weird swimming with my clothes on.
Well, yeah, like when you're filming, you can definitely understand why you would try and do things to make people feel comfortable in that.
But also when we're filming people, they were naked a bit, maybe. Yeah. We were quite careful of what we.
Yeah. Done. Yeah. You just see a back. You don't really, you don't see anything. It's all tasteful, people. Don't worry.
We went through that frame by frame. And the editor was like, I was like, yeah, it's a bit too much. But I mean, it's that trust thing. You're like,
yeah.
I'd be mortified. Or not, I wouldn't be mortified. I'd be, if someone said, oh, I'm really, don't you've shown me too naked, I'd be, oh God, that'd be awful. Because it was a view, I would have got the trust line slightly wrong. But luckily, that was the one thing, actually. Vicky, and you, as you say, you see her kind of, well, you see Clive's bum, and he's slightly exhibitionist, so I don't think he minds so much. And then you see Vicky kind of ducking down, you know, her naked back. And I was like, oh, that was one thing I was quite nervous about in the screening because none of them had seen it. We did it like a preview thing at Heaven and Bridge Arts Festival. And that was the one thing I was most worried about. And when she didn't bring it up, I was like quite relieved.
Well, I mean, it's a back. Like a back is fine, you know.
Yeah, but you know, but it's on a big screen and it's been on film. You never, I mean, I thought it was fine, but there was, you're not quite sure where that line is. You can have a guess. And it was happy. I think I could have gone, I think it's fine, and it would have been fine. But yeah, anyway, it was all fine, and it's not, there's not much nakedness. But Clive is actually known as the naked swimmer.
Okay.
And he's quite happy to get all his bits off. Bits of, yeah, and he always clears it first, but you can see sometimes people go, oh, yeah, fine, and think, oh, don't know where to look.
But like, does it, because the thing I was most curious about was, like, what difference does it give to the person? You know what I mean? Like, going in naked to going in with, you know, a bathing suit on, like, what's the, like, is there a clear difference in the feeling, the sensation, the emotional attachment to it?
Good question. I don't know. Possibly not. I guess it's a more rawer or a more honest experience, because I suppose it's the sensation of being in the water and being aligned with the elements and aligned with nature. So I guess the less you have between you and that experience, then the more pure that is, I suppose.
Okay.
I mean, some people go, I mean, when I was filming, I'd be in a thick wetsuit with a GoPro, and you can see some of it that it starts shaking a bit, because I sat there for like 10 or 15 minutes. It does, you do start chilling down even in a thick wetsuit. But I've lost my thread there. I can't remember what I was going to say.
That the connectivity with the water.
Yeah. Oh, that was it. And so what I used to do when, and some people do, is when you first go swimming, everyone goes, oh, I don't really fancy kind of the you know, not wearing a wetsuit. And I'll just, going with just my trunks when it's cold. But it's a hassle to get on. And then when you get out and you're pulling a wetsuit on, it's a real pain in the ass. It's the
worst. God, that
exactly. Like, and if there's
going surfing, that was always love surfing. Getting out that wetsuit was just the biggest pain in the ass.
Yeah, exactly. So, so if you're only planning on being in for what, 5-10 minutes, actually, you can be dressed and warm, and you'll be looking at someone still trying to, you know, toss all the way out of a wetsuit. And you just think, well, you know, it's always more trouble than it's worth. It's just, you might as well not bother. But having said that, yeah, for filming, I used a thick wetsuit and just as well, really.
Yeah.
And it's surprising how you can get cold in, you know, quite warm water quite quickly.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, well, anything under 30 degrees, isn't it? Anything under your body temperature, is it, are we 30 degrees, something like that, and anything under that, if you sat still for long enough, you would eventually die of hypothermia because you just start chilling down.
Yeah, and when you're filming, you have to stand, you're standing still, well, stiller than if you were swimming. So wetsuit definitely makes sense.
Well, the coldest we all got was, we've got a friend who's got like one of these super high speed cameras, like really high speed. And he kind of came up and we did a day's filming with him, which unfortunately we didn't end up using any of it. But there was a lot of standing around in wetsuits and a lot of swimming. And at the end of that day, I think it was summer, it's springtime probably. And it wasn't cold, but it wasn't warm. And by the end of the day, man, I was freezing. But all the other bits, you know, because also when you're filming people swimming, that they can only stay in for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
You have got to really grab what you can. And yeah, I mean, it was quite tricky in the edit because we only had one, because it's all low budget. And because we only had myself, who wasn't, you know, was kind of filming in the water, maybe the GoPro or whatever, and we had the DOP, Jeff, And you know, you're like, especially if it's really cold and the ice swimming, you're like, well, you know, people aren't going to be in there more than 3 or 4 minutes. So once it's go, it's all systems go, and I'm trying not to be in Jeff's eye line, and he's trying, you know. So there is this real, you've just got to grab what you can while you can. Again, which is a quite nice thing about imposing those limits, because there was no going back and redoing it. We just stop people swimming on different occasions, but you can't go, can you just go back in again? Because then, you know, well, you, it's slightly, it's not dangerous, but you know, you need to just be conscious of safety and getting warm. And so again, quite a nice way of having to film it that way, really. Capture the moment.
Yeah, but there definitely was some really nice shots of the, you know, in the water, people swimming. Like, there was some underwater shots and stuff, which I was curious how you got those. So you were in your wetsuit beside someone filming.
Exactly that. I had a GoPro, the new GoPro Hero 5, which is brilliant. I just had it on a stick and basically pointed it and kept my fingers crossed. I mean, obviously, when it was out the water, it's fine, but underwater, you know, because it doesn't work on the app when it's filming, so you're just like, okay, we'll keep our fingers crossed, slow-mo, and let's see what comes out.
Yeah, you know what, Ben? I think Martin Scorsese said the same thing about Killer Moon. He was just like, yeah, I just, you know, pointed the camera and just crossed my fingers, right?
I think he might know slightly more about it than I do. I think he might have a bit more of a high spec crossing his fingers than I have. I was literally like, here you go, let's see what happens. I mean, we did some other like really fun filming stuff. We did we filmed the mountain rescue. Again, I mean, I spoke to the DOP and we had about 30 hours of footage and he said, I think it's about 30-1 ratio of film to finished film, footage to film. Yeah. And it's not far off what we've come out with. But one of the story, well, not a story, just, well, what I wanted to do was get this slice of life of, oh, some mountain bikers, we'll have a chat with them, and just this sense of community kind of in touch with people, not in touch, and kind of moving around the water. And one of them was the Mountain Rescue, who used dogs. So we attached a GoPro to the back of one of the dogs, and we did this whole, so you got this dog kind of running around with the GoPro around on top, and the footage is great, but we just couldn't, as a load of this stuff, we just, you know, it's that thing, if it's not feeding the story, it's like, what's it there for? Everything's got to have, you know, earn its place within the edit, and unfortunately that didn't, but it's the same with the slow-mo stuff, but it was really fun to do. And yeah, that's part of the thing of filming. It's like, oh, do you want to go out for an afternoon with the mountain rescue and the dogs? It's like, God, would I ever? Yeah, great.
it does sound like an experience. And also, it's just like, you might not have used it with this film, but you now understand how that works. And you might incorporate it into something else in the future.
Yeah, that is true. Well, I've lost my thread again. Oh, what was I going to say? So what? Because all that footage, what I wanted to do was use it for, you know, I'm like, oh, well, when it's done, I'll do all these great little mini shorts and use it for Instagram and all that. And of course, never got bloody any time to do anything. So that's just not happened. And it'd be nice to think at some point I'll maybe do something with the slow-mo, because it is absolutely amazing. You know when you get the kind of the David Attenborough, the drop off the plant, and it just does and it looks amazing. But yeah, we just couldn't crowbar it in. But yeah, so maybe I'll try and do that. I think when the soundtrack's out, I could maybe set some of that to music. It might work quite nicely. That's giving me an idea, actually.
Oh, that sounds great. Yeah. Like, what was the editing process like? How much did the film change in the editing room?
The process edit, Kevin, was grueling. I think Joe, the editor, thought it was going to take 6 weeks. It took us 5 months. Oh, man, it was... Yeah, God, blah. Have you done editor? Are you an editor, or have you done editor?
No.
Oh, none God, it is black magic, that stuff. God, it is. Yeah, it was. Well, do you know, it was true to what I wanted it to be. But we went in with a... I mean, that's that thing with that communication, maybe a little bit. And that I went in with an idea of what I wanted, and it was all in my head. But when you've got 30 hours of footage, actually trying to piece all that together is... Mm. It was really difficult, actually. Well, yeah, really difficult. It was long, and there was definitely a moment in the middle where it was just like, oh, God, what are we doing here? What are we doing? Where are we going? Which I think it may well be common to most films. But we definitely had a breakthrough in the lady Emma I mentioned earlier who couldn't have kids. And we'd done a huge, I really wanted it to be her thing to be really kind of a very heavy, sounds a bit overburdened, deep kind of exploration of her childlessness. And we did a lot of interviews at her house and everywhere. And then every time the film got to it, it would just sag. And then we were a bit like, oh, we can't take that right out. Can't spend, you know, about 6 weeks there, we can't take it out. And we took it out, and suddenly you're like, oh, God, that's better. And we kept everything at the dam, used some of her voiceover from the interviews, and it just freed the whole thing. So you have these, you get so attached to some of the footage, and it's very, very difficult to let it go. And simplicity is always best. Same with music. I mean, when I make my music, it's the thing I do is you keep piling it in, because I'm not a great musician, but again, I know what I want. And then so I feel like I'm slightly overcompensating by filling it. Mm. But actually, you listen to the best music is either simple or deceptively simple, and you go, there's actually, you know, bass line and drum beat, that's all you need. So simple is always better, and trying to do too much, it's like a documentary. You can't tell the first film, Northern Disco Lights, and at first it's like, well, we've got to tell everything, and it's like, you can't, if you miss bits of the story, that's fine. You've got to tell a story in a certain way, and if someone else wants to make another story about another part of it, that's fine. But otherwise, you just get swamped. You can't please everyone. You just get swamped by it. So yeah, the editing was quite tough, actually, and we definitely got there in the end, but it was pretty grueling.
Like when you're having the conversations with people, like you know, with Vicky, and when she's talking about the childlessness, were there certain points where you're like, we need to use that, that's great, like this bit's great, so you mark it down in your head, you'd be like, okay, right, that bit we've got to use, you know what I mean? So did that help in a way? Did you do those sorts of things?
Yeah, definitely. There's definitely, you have moments, a bit like I was talking about earlier, like the Eros dad, Otero's dad, when he started crying, and you're like, you're this sounds awful, but when people start crying, you're kind of slightly punching the air, because you're going, oh, well, this is great. You know, they've let themselves go, and they're really giving themselves up. And there's a little bit of you going, this is going to look good on film. This is great. So there are, you definitely have these moments. There's a bit when Sarah, another of the characters, and she essentially, she had a she married for 25 years, kind of two teenage kids, and then this is her word, she said, I had an epiphany or mental breakdown. Mm. She essentially, and there was more to the story, her dad had just died and all sorts of other things, and then she essentially kind of packed a rucksack and left, like, yeah, without a look back, and went and traveled around the world and kind of rediscovered her. And as she was telling that story, which is a very powerful story, I mean, it's unbelievable, and then she and she started crying, and it is, you go, well, this will make the cut, because it's powerful stuff. And you do get these moments, you go, and also when people say something, certain interviewees, like Sarah, is very much talked in circles, and editing her was difficult because she got on tangents. And then there's another of the characters, she's almost like a narrator, Jemima. and she talks in these very short, succinct, direct, understandable, beautiful way. And everything she says, you're like, that's brilliant. That's brilliant. That's brilliant. And almost saying exactly what you want and what I want her to say. Because I'm like, yeah. Well, I go into an interview thinking I want this to come across. Sometimes it just comes out. And also you can be quite leading, and some interviewees are better than that. You know, I'll be like, so let me think of it. I can't think of an example. But, you know, I will lead them in what I would like them to say, which is what I want their story, because everyone's got their story, but I've got to send it in a direction and pick those little parts of it out that I know will make the film more fit in the other bit. So I lead them in that direction. And sometimes I can ask quite a pointed question, and they will not far off repeat it back to me, and it, you know, which is a little bit of a cheat, but like, it's fine.
Well, as you said, it's all techniques, right? It's techniques to try and get things out. Because, yeah, there's some people that you will automatically do that thing, as you said, with Jemima. But then there's other people that, yeah, can meander all over the place. So you got to kind of be like, all right, you know what I mean? This is where we're going.
Yeah, Sarah, she's a free spirit, that's for sure. She's brilliant. She's hilarious. But it's her life is... oh God, it's amazing. And that's that thing of just finding people's stories. You know, my wife actually cut her hair. And she said, oh, she likes wild swimming. She's a you know, quite a character. And I got in touch with her. And you know, suddenly you pick at a thread, and she's got this unbelievable story. You know, she nearly committed suicide in Dubai on the back of this, estranged from her daughter. A daughter was pregnant. She was, oh God. So the bit we didn't even put in, we touched on it, but she basically was, she found out she was, hey, let me get this right. It's quite, I think her mother was a drug addict, had her when she was 16. Essentially, she went into the Salvation Army as a baby. Then she got given to her adopted mother over a train station platform.
Oh, damn.
And then they were her adopted parents were so terrified that she was going to get taken off, and they went and lived abroad for a year until it was the paperwork had been done or whatever.
Right, right.
And then they didn't tell her she was adopted until she was 14 or something, which is, you know, why it all kind of plays into this, her story of why she just kind of picked up and went one day. But I mean, you know, that, I mean, what a story. And that's that thing of, I really wanted to get all that in, but it just gets, it's too much. You're like, it's such a good story, but actually you've got to distill it and pick apart and just get down to the nub of it. And it's all kind of there bubbling under. I mean, that was just someone who drew her hair, and then suddenly you're like, oh wow, she's got this amazing story. And I bet, you know, a lot of people, you could talk to them, and they will all have stuff going on, you know, to them or the relations or their friends or whatever.
It was nice that at the very end we get that little addition to her story.
Oh, right, the happy ending.
Yeah. You know, well, she's all that stuff, and then we get just at the end, you get that little, and you're like, oh, okay. Nice.
Yeah, she's the only one really with a kind of a narrative arc, because everyone else, I mean, Emma, the childlessness lady, did, but that was the thing we ended up actually not using in the end. But yeah, so she, at the beginning, Sarah is estranged from her daughter, and she's gotten pregnant, and then at the end they've kind of made up, and she's started getting involved in her grandchild's life. And obviously she was estranged from her daughter because she'd left her high and dry at the age of 15 and whatever, and kind of left home.
Which you can understand why.
I know, 100%. Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I thought another really good line, that I really, one of my favorite lines in it, is she goes, and now we're talking, my daughter can get me to know the person I am now, as in she's changed into something else. And she said she couldn't have stayed, because she would have dragged herself to death, essentially. But still, to walk out like that, I mean, God, that is another example. I mean, that's another thing as a documentary maker, you just got to be not non-judgmental. Yes. I mean, totally. I mean, you know, you could hear that story of someone, if you knew them, be like, you'd be horrified. But you, it's, who knows? Who are we to judge anyone? It's, everyone has different reasons and different stuff, and you don't know what goes on in people's heads. And yeah, I don't know. It's, I think that's something also, yeah, I bring as a filmmaker, hopefully, is being non-judgmental. And I'm not, I can put myself, in fact, yeah, I can put myself in that place. I mean, I used to volunteer for the Samaritans a long time ago. Oh. But that really taught me being non-judgmental. And yeah, it's a skill that has carried through. And also something that's carried through from that is asking direct questions. Because we, you know, in the UK, we fudge around so much. In fact, the DOP is Australian. And we, you know, you do a lot of talking, especially walking up and down that hill. I don't know, you know, what you think of the British and you know, coming here. And he's like, oh, my God, why does no one say what they think? Like, just, he said it took me years to just work out what people mean, because no one says what they mean. And I think with the documentary maker, also going back to what we said earlier, it's like it gives you a license to ask a direct question. So why haven't you had kids? You know, why did you leave home? Why? Which you wouldn't dream of asking in other circumstances.
Oh, God, yeah. No.
And it's not your business. Yeah, exactly. Unless someone invites you to have that conversation, you're, why, you know, you shouldn't ask, I guess. But there's something very appealing about a direct question, even when we're in Norway and people will say things to you very directly and you're like, oh, wow, okay, that's direct, but I quite like it.
Well, yeah, there's the honesty to it. Right, there's sometimes, you know, people are thinking a thing but they're not saying it, and it's just like, just say the thing, man, you know what I mean? So it's what there's, yeah, when people are just like, yo, this is what I'm thinking, this is, you're like, you know where you stand on these different subjects and things, right? And I feel that's a better place to be in than people pretending something but secretly deep down they're like, and it's just a bit weird.
There's the British way, though, isn't it? I don't know. It's how we navigate. I mean, it's like people with kind of autism or whatever. And I think part of that is, you know, that can find it difficult to understand people. It's like, because no one's actually saying what they mean. It's all these little codes that they can't pick up on.
Yeah. No, for sure. But you did a great job of telling all of those different stories. I did, I think with Vicky, it was nice when she was just like, yeah, you know, I met my partner and it was like, he had kids. So it was that, having that choice, right? What do you really want in life? And it's just like, you know, and it kind of, you'd be like, yeah, essentially, like, you'd want to be happy.
Yeah.
So if being with that person makes you happy, do that thing. Because I was kind of thinking, like, there's also adoption. Like, I was curious if she'd kind of thought about that. But, yeah, like, having her go, yes, I chose happiness. You're like, that's good. Mm. I like that. That's nice.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of wondered with Emma if it was about other things as well, which we, there was more, because she's almost consumed by the having, not having kids. And it's, it's, I always wondered if that was a standalone thing or there's other things played into it. I don't know. The lives and emotional lives are complicated, aren't they? And all, you know, nothing's black and white, and all sorts of things feed into things. And she had gone down that adoption route and gone down the IVF route, which they said, you know, it probably wouldn't work for you. And I think for that, her, it could have been, it was a binary choice, because her partner, husband, Miles, didn't want kids. So, you know, you think, and she did. So if she'd wanted kids, she would have, that was a binary choice. And it was the right, well, I'm not one to say it's the right one, but he's lovely and she's lovely. And they live a good life now. I mean, she still battles with it. Very much so.
Mm.
She definitely seems in a better place. And she, you know, she does therapy now. And she said that it was great, because she said that the fact that we'd started the filming, it really inspired her to go and kind of seek more help.
Oh,
that was nice to hear as well.
Yeah. Huh.
It gives you some self-reflection, doesn't it? And you start seeing yourself through other people's eyes a bit more. Who knows?
Yeah. Like, what was that hill like? Right? Because when people are like, just 20 minutes, you think that's not bad. And then some people are like, oh, it's killer. But you just think if you do it every day, you should be all right.
Yeah, I kind of think it's all right. We had a cameraman who was we're not the main guy. We just used one chat, that the sunny day, which I wanted to catch, because that was another thing with filming up there, because you're at mercy to the elements. So I really wanted to catch. I wanted to have a super windy day, wanted to have a hot sunny day, wanted to have a snowy day. And we went up on the summer's day, first day of filming we did, and we had a cameraman who was very unfit. And I think it took him an hour and a half, and he was sick twice going up.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. I don't think exercise was at the top of his agenda. And he really struggled. And then we went down because there's some scenes of the traffic. I wanted to get the traffic wardens going up and down for the parking. And we went down. He's like, tell me we're not going up again, Ben. I'm like, we're going up again. So, yeah, I mean, I carried all his gear as well. So I carried all his gear and I had a nice hour swim before he got to the top again. So it's a fitness thing. I mean, it doesn't bother me in the slightest of the film. But yeah, I mean, a lot of people who live around there are kind of used to going up and down hills. It's hilly. Whereas I can understand if you're not used to that, it could be quite not as easy, not that easy. The path, terrible, actually, having said that. So that's actually not that easy because it's been so eroded over time. But there are easier ways to go up. There's a really nice way going up that's a little bit longer and it's far more gradient. And it's a super nice walk. So there are all sorts of different ways of scaling the wall. And also it's the reward when you get up there. That's what I quite like about it. I think you've got a bit of a sweat on, so you know you're warm, ready to go in, and you feel like you've earned it a little bit. It's a bit of an oasis. It's a bit of a oh my god, like this is, yeah, if you discovered it and it was up there, I mean it's amazing. And it does feel like it shouldn't be there. You're on top of this more, because you can't see it from below, you can't see it from anywhere. The sun, you get up and it's like there's just this massive lake. Yeah, it's quite beautiful. It's quite beautiful. It is, but the hill is the hateful hill, as Vicky keeps calling it. It is quite, yeah, it's got a certain amount of steepness to it.
Oh, man. I realize you've probably got things to do, but I was just very curious.
Yeah.
What led you to filmmaking, right? Because you'd had this, you know, long career in music.
Yeah.
So what was it that made you go, I'd like to tell stories in this different way?
Well, do you know what? Nothing actually made me want to actually do it. It was kind of just an idea. I mean, I've always loved film documentaries, but then we had a meeting with a Norwegian funding agency. It's 10 years ago now, for one of our artists who we wanted to get over touring. And they said, but just before we went in, we were just like, well, we'll, you know, if we can't get the funding for the Provint Audio, the artist, we'll ask about some other stuff. And we literally kind of pinged it around between ourselves, and one of them was make a film on Norwegian dance music. And we went in and they weren't interested in the touring stuff, or it didn't fit their remit. And then it was the last thing we said. It was a bit like that Alan Partridge Monkey Tennis. We were like, film on Norwegian dance music, and they went, oh yeah, that's a great idea, we'd be really interested in that. If you want to put something together, we could be up for getting involved in that. And me and Pete are like, oh right, okay. Maybe we'll, okay, let's have a go. And then as we started doing it we kind of, we, I think we were quite lucky with it, and we met the right the guy we ended up making with it did all the filming. We met instantly. And so, yeah, we just kind of fell into it rather than wanting to do it. And from a personal point of view, it definitely filled in a gap of meeting people and going travel, which is what I used to do when I was DJ. I used to DJ a lot and go around the world with it. And there you'd meet people, get taken out for dinner, or, you know, become friends with people. And yeah, you'd almost see a scene or a city as a local, and you would see something you wouldn't just get if you just turned up as a tourist. But it definitely gave me that. And you've got an instant in as well. It's like DJing, you've got music and you've all got something in common, and you're working towards a common goal. And it was the same with filmmaking, and it really kind of, yeah, it pricked that part of me that needs to be fulfilled. And it's so creative as well. It's like, I think if you're a creative person, it doesn't kind of matter what it is, apart from art in my case, because I can't draw at all. But, you know, it's all, I see it in a similar way to making music. And I, you know, it's great. We can do the art side of it, and I've been part of a team. We've done the music for it. It's all part of the same thing somehow. So, yeah. And now we've done it, and, you know, I'm 55. So I'm a bit like, okay, well, there's a limited, because a film takes a good 2 or 3 years. So we're like, okay, well, we've got a limited amount of time to do these things. So, yeah, we've got our next project lined up, which is on Musical Outsiders, which I mentioned at the beginning, which we've done a little bit of filming, but we've got COVID put an end to. So we're picking that up again, which I'm really excited about, because that's a lot about kind of mental health and people very much on the fringes of society and creativity. But actually, there's something incredibly inspiring and uplifting and exciting about that. But I haven't quite worked out how it's going to be done yet. I've got a few ideas. I need to, in the next few weeks, I'm going to try and start putting that together. So we're just kind of excited about just cracking on with it, really.
Okay. I love, music is so great, right? It was just, you know, going to like certain clubs growing up, right, as a kid, and you're 15, but you're like, hell yeah, I'm this age, and you're getting into the clubs, and it just changes everything. Things might be shitty at school and you're going for your GCSEs and all of this kind of thing, but the minute the music comes on, all of that stuff falls away. And then you have this camaraderie with these other people enjoying the music in the room. And you don't know these people, but a certain track comes on and you look at someone and you're like, yes. And they're just, you know what I mean? And it's just great. It's just, it does so many incredible things, man.
Well, it's a shared experience, isn't it? There's an energy in a room or in a community that is, yes, it's almost tangible. You're right. It's not a communication. It's a joining. It's an energy between people that I think only music can do, really, playing and listening to. And, you know, and if you're dancing in a club, you're participating in it, and you're creating this thing that is, amazing. And it takes you back. You can listen to a certain tune. You're like, oh, man, it all just comes in, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, because there's this connectivity to music and moments, right? A song can come on and you'd be like, oh my God, I was walking down the street when I first heard that song and this happened. I haven't thought about that in years, but it just comes back to you because this song comes on and it just recreates that imagery for you, right? And you can talk of, like, me and my girlfriend, we sit around talking about music for hours, and it'd be like, oh, remember when that was playing and this was going on? And it's just like, oh yeah, and you can have these, you know, similar experiences around music, which is crazy.
Well, it's interesting. I've been really interested in how I'm quite aware of it, of how my musical taste has developed, is the wrong word, but changed and matured, or whatever you want to call it. But, you know, I've kind of, I can, you know, started off as well, in the 80s kids music, and then I was really into indie and then kind of psychedelia, and then, you know, I had my first E, and then it was all dance music and then, you know, discovering kind of this whole world of black music, and now I'm into like really into African music, and it's just, and a lot of the guitar music I listened to at the beginning, I'm just like, oh, I can't listen to it now. So it's, I'm really interested in aware of how, you know, you go down these little wormholes and it opens this whole world of kaleidoscopic world of music that's fascinating and interesting and inspiring and all these things. Oh, it's yeah, I love it.
Oh man, yeah, I can't wait for this next documentary, man.
Yeah, me neither. Work out what it is first. It's a good idea. I'm just gonna try and again, it's that, we'll go to what I said earlier. It's like, I've done quite a bit of research on it. It's like, and it's actually a huge subject matter that it's a bit like, well, do we try and tell the whole thing or do we just try and pick some strands out, which I think is what we need to do. And it's all, again, it's all about in the characters, and I've got some characters, some people in mind. But I just, I need to kind of put a bit of flesh on my research. And this one, we're going to try and get some money in because we've self-financed Wild Water. So this feels like we're going to actually, I think we need to kind of step up a gear for it, which will be an interesting process for us, as in maybe we'll have, you know, some investment and people might have their own opinions on what we should do, which I'm slightly nervous about. I say, because, it's like, how do you compromise your creative vision? But that's, you know, I guess that's the world we live in. We'll see. Mm-hmm. I'll let you know on that.
Well, yeah, when you're ready to talk about it, man, please definitely come by and we can have another great conversation.
Sounds good, man. Sounds good.
Awesome.
Well, thank you for having me, Kevin. I really enjoyed it. It's been great fun.
Yeah, no worries, man. I appreciate the time and opportunity. But where can people find out about the film and follow what you're doing? Let the people know.
Yeah, well, the film, you can, we are on, it's on Wild Water. I always get it wrong.
.net, isn't it?
I think it's .net. Yeah. We're on Instagram, Wild Water Film, and it will be. We need to get distribution. So hopefully, it will be out in the new year. Is what we're hoping. We'll be doing selected screenings around the country. I think probably January, February, March, music wise, Paper Recordings is our record label. You know, all the usual. It's got one R in the middle, which is a bit annoying, Paper Recordings. And then Flash Atkins is my personal stuff. I'm on SoundCloud and Instagram and Facebook and all the rest of it. So, awesome. Yeah, that's where you can find us.
All right. Well, people, all the links will be on the website. So make sure you go follow Ben so you can find out when the film might be screening near you, and where you might be able to go and have a swim and greet, right?
So, there you go.
Yeah.
Well, I've just realized, Kevin, I've gone completely dark now.
Yeah, no, it was getting darker. As time was going.
If I thought about it, I would have turned the lights on before we started.
It's fine because, you know, I think what you're saying is so intriguing, like, you know, and compelling. You know, that's the thing that people are going to be attached to, right? And then it becomes very, intriguing. But it's just like, who's the guy in the dark? Like, silhouette.
We should have done it the other way around. If it had been dark, and then it would have slowly come up. We'll do the next one with, we'll get up at 6 and just do it the other way around, just for the synergy of it.
Oh, fantastic. All right, Ben. Well,
really nice one, Kevin. Cheers, mate. Time, cheers. See you later.
Bye. Yo, so there we go. That is us for this week, right? Now, I will say, you know what I mean? Like, open swimming, you know, and just the way these crazy motherfuckers are doing it, it does make for an intriguing, like, story, you know? So, it's definitely an eye-opener, people. And Ben, oh man, that, I mean, what a crazy story, right? Just deciding to make this documentary and just how he got into filmmaking just in general, right? Really fun conversation. So go check out Ben. I don't have the release information as yet, but as Ben said, they are in talks with people. So if you go follow everyone on Instagram and their socials, you'll find out, right? That's when it will drop. So yeah, unless it's, you know, you find it at a festival near you, yeah, just stay tuned, man, and you'll see when this will be dropping in the greater world. All right, so yeah, go follow Ben Davis, and if you can, check out Wild Water. But remember, people, in part one of this week's episode, we looked at what Renfield dashing through the snow, a haunting in Venice, Rustin, and Leo. So yeah, don't miss part one, right? Share with your friends, go subscribe to the YouTube, right? Find the podcast and all your favorite podcast platforms. People, we will see you next week. And I think we have got 2 episodes dropping next week, right? So, yeah, until then, peace.